80s. Again, that's Varsity Cheerleader Werewolves Live from Outer Space, the musical, showing March 16th through March 31st on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. We're creeping up on 11 a.m., at which time Project Censored discusses the Me Too campaign and how corporate media portrays sexual harassment and violence. How is KBOO able to do that? It's with the support of the community. And so I will now thank the members of the KBOO Foundation. Yes, you, for your support. To keep informed and to get involved, go to kboo.fm. Click on the little magenta rectangle that says donate in yellow letters to get started. Use KBOO's safe, convenient, easy, and secure web form to make your fully tax-deductible 501c3 type, quote, charitable donation, unquote. This isn't charity, folks. We know better. This is solidarity. And speaking of which, here's Project Censored.
We want to smash, crash, bash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared, this is the vision. We want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we look at the true history of whistleblowers, drone warfare, and mass surveillance. We'll talk with authors of a new book, Varax, which means truth teller, as Pratap Chatterjee and Khalil Bendib join the conversation. In the second half of the show, we'll shift our focus to the hashtag MeToo campaign, sexual harassment, and the media. We'll be joined by Professor Julie Frechette, co-president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll start by looking at a true history of whistleblowers, drone warfare, and mass surveillance. And we'll be speaking with authors of a new book called Varax. Pratap Chatterjee and Khalil Bendib are here. In the second part of the program, we'll shift to sexual harassment, the media, and of course the new hashtag MeToo campaign. We'll be joined by Professor Julie Frechette. In this segment of the program today, we are joined by two authors, one of which is also an editorial cartoonist, a political cartoonist, and we'll be talking about their newest publication, a graphic novel called Varax. It's out by Metropolitan Books, and I'm joined right now by Pratap Chatterjee and Khalil Bendib. Pratap Chatterjee is executive director of CorpWatch, and he's the author of Halliburton's Army, Iraq Inc., A Profitable Occupation, The Earth Brokers, and Nether Time. He has previously worked as global environment editor for Interpress Service and is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He's been published widely in newspapers and publications around the world, as well as been interviewed in numerous media outlets. Pratap Chatterjee, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
Khalil Bendib is a political cartoonist whose work is distributed to over 2,000 small and mid-sized newspapers nationwide and has been published in the New York Times, USA Today, and Los Angeles Times and other major newspapers. His work has been commissioned by organizations such as Global Exchange, Greenpeace, Kaiser Permanente, and Oxfam, among others. He's co-author of the New York Times bestseller Zahra's Paradise, a graphic novel published in 16 languages worldwide. Khalil's cartoonist for the annual Censored Books out by Seven Stories Press. And Khalil Bendib, it is great to have you join us on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. It's great to be here.
Khalil Bendib, let's start with you because this is a graphic novel, Varax, the true history of whistleblowers, drone warfare, and mass surveillance. Certainly stories that we've long covered on the Project Censored Show. But how did this project come about with you and Pratap Chatterjee?
Well, I always wanted to do a graphic novel about whistleblowers, people like Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and others. And when Edward Snowden came up with his revelations in June 2013, I decided, okay, this is it. I'm gonna jump and do something. And I knew that ProTap, this was his beat. He knew most of these people, like Julian Assange, etc. I didn't know Edward Snowden, but I asked him, would he join me and do this graphic novel? And he said yes. So that's how it happened.
It's good to not only know people, but know people that have such prolific backgrounds and such widespread information base on these kinds of affairs. And ProTap Chatterjee, you've been writing about these varied affairs for a very long time. So this was an exciting proposal for you.
Indeed it was. Graphic novels is not my beat. I mean, I write for the internet, I write for newspapers, I've done radio, I've done television, but comics never. Khalil and I actually have worked together for many years. We've probably done 100 cartoons together, where I wrote an article and he turned it into a cartoon. So we had collaborated before, but the idea of writing a novel, it was entirely new to me. So I had to learn that.
It's actually not a novel. It's when you say graphic novel, it's a little bit misleading because this is totally nonfiction.
Correct.
It is a work of journalism in the medium of comics, a relatively new genre that was, I think, invented by Joe Sacco up in Portland. So I've been doing this sort of thing for a while now. My previous book that you mentioned, Tsarist Paradise, so that one was fiction, but it was so closely tied to a real event that most people were almost confused. They thought perhaps it was nonfiction. That one was fiction. This one is nonfiction. It's basically following the work of people like Edward Snowden and really the work of ProTap Chatterjee as an investigative journalist. So he's one of the main protagonists in the book, as well as Laura Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden.
And I would urge listeners to go to veraxcomic.net, veraxcomic.net. You can learn a lot more about it. You can even order copies of it, Metropolitan Books. ProTap Chatterjee, Khalil was just telling us how the book starts out looking at whistleblowers. And again, nonfiction, we're talking about Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, and so forth. And then later, the book really has you as the protagonist. But to give us a little bit about the narrative, what's the flow of Verax?
I think the way to really look at this book is to, for those listeners that have heard of Edward Snowden, and I would imagine that most of your listeners have, when he broke the news in 2013 of the fact that the United States was spying on pretty much everyone on the planet, was able to gather their metadata from their telephone calls, from their emails, people saw this as a vast invasion of privacy, and people were outraged. And there's been a lot of anger around that and mobilizing. Our book actually takes this a lot further because it explains why the surveillance, why the mass surveillance. And really, it is in order, and this is, you know, the military itself will, and the intelligence community themselves will admit it, the purpose of this is to find people to kill, to track quote-unquote terrorists. The problem with that, of course, is this data is inherently misleading often. Even if you have a lot of information about people, joining the dots together is very difficult. That's what the book is about. Verax actually means truth teller.
In Latin.
In Latin, yes.
And used to be one of Snowden's pseudonyms, Verax, truth teller, which we thought was very appropriate. It's about not just Snowden. It's about the whistleblowers who take great risks, personal risks, to tell the truth, speak truth to power, as we say, and journalists who are also in the same sphere, like Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, who suffer quite a bit of oppression, political oppression, to be able to do what they do.
And other whistleblowers, from John Curiaco to Thomas Drake.
Exactly. Thomas Drake is in the book. Yes. He's one of the NSA-4, I think they call them.
We start out actually by talking to the NSA-4, so Bill Binney, Ed Loomis, Thomas Drake, and Kirk Wiebe. And as we progress through the story, that's prior to Snowden's revelations, they are, as Khalil said, the NSA-4, the first to reveal these secrets of mass surveillance. A lot of people didn't believe them, partly because they had no documentation. And Snowden brought this news to the world because he had proof.
And also because the government was lying to us. The government, people like James Clapper, who we show in the book, was actually specifically, explicitly lying under oath, saying, no, we don't do things like knowingly, quote unquote, as if they were innocent. They didn't really mean to spy on people.
And after we introduce that and we explain how it works, we explain what we call the four different methods of surveillance, which is hacking, tracking, mass surveillance, and analysis, we then follow my path in trying to figure out why this surveillance. And then we meet a whole new cast of whistleblowers. These are the drone whistleblowers, all of whom worked for the U.S. Air Force. They're all veterans. And mind you, even though they're veterans, they're actually mostly, you know, age 25 to 30. They've left the military, graduated from high school, joined the military, and then after they left, they've come forward to speak at great personal risk.
Some of these drone pilots?
So they're not drone pilots, actually. They're drone operators.
Operators, correct.
Because many of them are what are called sensor operators. The pilots themselves have never come forward. And there's that's an interesting part of the book and the whole history. Pilots typically are graduates, right? And they're officers, right? They're 25 and above. The bulk of the work, the following, listening to people, following people, watching them from the air, is done by enlistees, you know, grunts who've come straight out of high school. They're typically 19 or 20 years old. So they actually have PTSD much more than the pilot who's flying a plane and isn't quite as involved in following people and watching people in their daily lives. So this is actually not so much about the pilots, but the personnel.
Good distinction. But of course, it's also that, again, you mentioned these are very young people. And for very young people to have these traumatic experiences, I'm not saying that to belittle the victims of the drone strikes in any way, and hierarchically, of course, but for these young people to experience this and then have the courage to come forward.
Because they've been traumatized and they're completely demoralized. They used to believe in the system, and as soon as they became part of it, they saw what it really meant. What our book does, that's, I think, an important contribution, is that beyond just the invasion of privacy, which is huge and a very important topic for U.S. citizens, where we're not supposed to be spied on by our own government, beyond that and beyond the implications for U.S. democracy, there's also these people who are actually dying by the thousands who are innocent outside of our borders, sometimes U.S. citizens, like the Yemeni...
Anwar al-Awlaki, and his son, and his daughter.
Who's a U.S. citizen, was put on the list to kill and was killed.
As was his 8-year-old daughter by Donald Trump and his 16-year-old son by Barack Obama.
Under Democrat Obama, Republican Trump. Again, this is an ongoing
thing. It's a bipartisan
thing.
Affair.
And worst of all, around these people who are on the list, dozens and hundreds of completely innocent people and celebrating weddings, you know,
euphemistically called collateral damage,
exactly.
By the Orwellian Department of Defense.
So the same system of mass surveillance, which here is spying on people and is actually killing people by the thousands abroad.
You hear very little reporting about those issues in the U.S. press, in the corporate press here. In Britain, of course, there are a couple of institutes, organizations that cover drone deaths and civilian deaths pretty well. Here, though, it's not a lot. I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm joined right now by author and journalist Protap Chatterjee, as well as author and political cartoonist Khalil Bendib. We're talking about their new book. It's called Verax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. So while reporting on the high civilian death toll from drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen, Protap Chatterjee, you began to suspect a link to the U.S. government's reliance on inaccurate electronic surveillance. That's sort of how on your website for veraxcomics.net begins talking about your book. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The book begins actually when I was working for one of those groups in Britain that you mentioned, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. So I was in London in 2011, living there and working for the Bureau, looking into initially surveillance, and the book opens with me looking at something called the spy files. And the spy files are actually brochures and classified documents issued by contractors who work for the U.S. government and indeed governments in Egypt, in Syria, pretty much everywhere in the world, helping them hack into private citizens' communications. And then it switches to the second group that you referenced briefly, which is Reprieve. And I traveled with them to Pakistan, where I met with families of drone victims. And where the book begins in some ways, plot becomes comes to life, is when I meet this young man by the name of Tariq Aziz, who was killed 3 days after him by the CIA. And this is not a theory. I mean, they admit as much. And in fact, they did an interview with the Washington Post in which they said, yes, we targeted Tariq Aziz and we killed him. So that sort of sets me off in trying to figure out, what technology does the Air Force use? Does the CIA use? How accurate is it? And soon after that, Edward Snowden came out, and we learned so much more about it, and it helped me along my way. And with the help of people like Laura Poitras, the filmmaker who made Citizen 4, I was able to put together some of this information and not least with the documents that I had received from WikiLeaks under the spy file system. So putting it all together, it becomes pretty obvious that, in fact, the data they're gathering is inaccurate, the analysis is flawed, and that is why so many people die. It's rare that they actually hit their targets. And you could even say these people have not even been afforded a fair system of trial, as you might in Guantanamo even.
Protap, perhaps then you can maybe give a little update on the number, at least the conservative estimate, a number that we know of civilians that have been killed. I mean, just even in the past couple of years, it was well over a couple thousand.
So the total number of people killed in drone strikes so far, that the reliable estimates from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, is around 6,000. So this is primarily Pakistan and Yemen, but also Afghanistan, Somalia, and Syria now. So we're not 100% sure because they don't publish statistics. They have started publishing some statistics. They claim the civilian death rate is 2 to 4%. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism says it's more like 22%. But any of these numbers are actually deeply flawed, because how do you know if somebody is guilty or innocent? I mean, in my opinion, if they have not been put on trial, if they have not been given a fair system, it's 100% a casualty rate. They're all innocent until proven guilty. So just because somebody watching a shaky video feed thinks they're guilty, or because somebody in the community has reported either to the military or to, even for that matter, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, they think that person's a terrorist, that doesn't actually conclusively prove anything. You have to.
No, it does not. It's very good of you, by the way, to remind everyone about these important constitutional principles that at various times in our history have obviously been ignored, but particularly post 9/11, they're not even paid lip service in many cases.
And we had Trump complain that the system is not working. It's too slow. He wants to hang people right there on the spot.
We're speaking with Protap Chatterjee and Khalil Bendib. They are the co-authors of a new book called Verax. It's a graphic novel, but of course it's not a novel. It's nonfiction. The subtitle, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. If you'd like to learn more about the authors and the book, please go to veraxcomic.net. That's veraxcomic.net. If you'd like to learn more about Protap Chatterjee, you can also go to corpwatch.org. And also Khalil Bendib's artwork can be found at bendib.com, B-E-N-D-I-B. Khalil Bendib, let's talk about your art, because this is a graphic book. And, of course, I hope the listeners in the Project Censored Show are very well aware of Khalil's work. Khalil is gracious enough to have his wit and wisdom grace the pages of the Censored Books every year on Seven Stories Press, does an original cartoon for us every year. Khalil, tell us about how this is different than, you know, the editorial, the op-ed kind of one-off kind of work that you normally do.
Yeah, it's very different because it's more like drawing a film. I always think of this graphic novel as a film. I receive the material from either Protap or before him from Amir, and I adapt it to the graphic form. Each page has to be a certain way. It has to be presented in a way that's visually appealing. And also there's got to be pacing. Even though we're talking about nonfiction, you want the book to read a little bit like a thriller, or in this case, a little bit, it's almost like a murder mystery kind of book, where we see Protap in the beginning looking, investigating, trying to figure out why this Tariq, this young 16-year-old Pakistani, was killed, what happened. So the job of the graphic novelist is to try to make sometimes very complex data, complex information, accessible and fun to read.
It's highly accessible, and there's been a boom, really, in kind of the graphic comic world and the comic journalism.
And the other difference between the political cartoons and this is visually the style. This is not as cartoony. It's not caricature. It's more realistic. It's more like, you know, something you might see in documentary or in the film.
And Protap, you've been writing about these issues and researching these issues for years. How was it for you to work with Khalil and, you know, have this vision and have this kind of script, almost like Khalil described, as sort of like a running film?
At first, it was a little hard to conceive how to write a graphic novel. I've never done anything like that. But once I figured out it was like writing a movie script, I've read books about that, or writing a play, it became a lot easier for me to conceive and to, you know, set up the three acts and that sort of thing. But of course, unlike writing a movie or a play where you already decide what's going to happen at the end. Half of this book actually took place as we were writing it, which made it very difficult because we couldn't say this is what's going to happen in Act 3 because Act 3 changed many times, right? Some chapters were rewritten 6 times and we had to always go back and then sometimes tweak what happened earlier so that it formed a cohesive narrative in the structure of cinema, the structure of a play. And of course, real life doesn't have simple beginnings and simple ends or simple answers or even simple questions. So that makes it much harder because you're trying to pull something out. And it's not like going back and writing a history, you know, of Robert Moses or of Nixon or some such thing. In fact, I think the last page, which is a quote from Chelsea Manning, probably occurred in June or July of 2017. So literally as we were turning it in to the publisher. So that makes it hard because you also don't know what's going to happen next with the elections. I mean, that twist, which was, you know, the election of Trump and what he would do with this incredible machinery that was created by Barack Obama's government was unknown. And so, you know, that was a bit nerve-wracking for us as to how we were going to present this, given that he might close it down or expand it greatly.
This quote is pretty apt. Would you say that it sums up in many ways what you're trying to do? I'll read the quote quickly. This is a quote from Chelsea Manning, and it's how Khalil Bandib and Protap Chatterjee conclude the Varax book. Chelsea Manning writes, "We're getting all this information from all these different sources, and it's just death, destruction, mayhem. We're filtering all through facts, statistics, reports, dates, times, locations, and eventually just stop. I stopped seeing just statistics and information, and I just started seeing people. I have a responsibility to the public. We all have a responsibility." And that's certainly what this book seems to be about.
And we hope that the book will serve as a call to action, particularly today, but this has always been true, in fact, very much under Obama, that we need people to come forward. We need the activists and the general public to be working in solidarity with brave veterans, government people. You don't have to agree with them on everything, but when they tell the truth, we have to stand up and support them. And that's really kind of the heart of the book, wouldn't you say, Khalil?
Absolutely, yeah. A call to action, resistance. I mean, now it's become fashionable to speak the word resistance, even
Hillary Clinton is resistant.
No, even she is.
The McResistance,
right,
trademarked that.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think we were there before before this new fad, and we were already resisting before resistance became cool.
Right. Well, nothing that you, Khalil, or Protap do is faddish. although certainly their struggle when all of a sudden it seems like, wait a minute, it almost looks like the so-called establishment, mainstream establishment. Are they talking about this same issue? And then you realize that, well, no, they're using some of the same words, but they're never actually talking about the same issue and certainly not from the same perspective.
Exactly.
This book actually does talk a lot about the Obama administration, but this is an administration that prosecuted and imprisoned more whistleblowers than all other presidents in history.
Combined.
This is an important fact.
So we're really talking about the Bush, Obama, Trump administration.
There is lineage there, right? And I mean, even though the face changes, a lot of the players behind the scenes aren't changing. And the policies either aren't changing or are
getting
worse.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a thread through them. And in fact, it's funny, my last book, Halliburton's Army, was about the Bush administration. And so people said, oh, yes, we know the story. This is the story of how Dick Cheney gave the contract to his buddies, you know, at Halliburton. And I'm like, actually, that's not entirely true. This is a long-standing history that dates back, you know, to the Vietnam War, where the Democrats gave contracts. And Donald Rumsfeld was protesting the awarding of contracts to Brown and Root, I think. So this is really a story of U.S. imperialism.
We quote Eisenhower, of all people, because he was the last president, U.S. president, to warn us about the military-industrial complex.
In Censored 2017, our 40th anniversary book, Shahid Batar from Electronic Frontier Foundation wrote an entire chapter on Ike's dystopian dream, riffing on all of that and talking about the mass surveillance and everything that was coming. But you're right. It seems as if we have to go back to a Republican war general president in 1961 to hear some semblance of truth about what's coming, right? And through that process of the last half century, we've just seen sort of a relentless barrage of normalization.
You know, we quote a fellow at the Center for Foreign Relations in the book, Micah Zenko, and in presenting to him and to other people who were in the administration, I'm constantly surprised that when you talk to people in the military at a high level, they are aware of the inaccuracies of the drone program. And they say this is really driven by the political administrations, the politicians, that they themselves are aware that, in fact, this doesn't work. There are a lot of soldiers who say, we're not winning a war by raining death on them from above, from across the world. It's not bringing peace. We're not winning a war.
If anything, it's bringing blowback.
Exactly.
Yes, certainly we know a lot about blowback, the Chalmers Johnson trilogy, the CIA term, right, that refers to the unintended aerial quotes consequences from these covert operations. That's just ongoing. And if you look at, you know, the Project for New American Century planned, you know, to unveil these wars in the Middle East, 2000, Rebuilding America's Defenses, and after 9/11, these same authors of these documents in the Bush administration basically just let loose with this. And now Yemen is one of the worst of the war-torn places in the region, and it's getting very little attention. Khalil Bandib, you mentioned before about taking action. And again, we're speaking with Khalil Bandib and Protap Chatterjee. Their new book is called Varax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. You can learn more at varaxcomic.net. There is a link on that page about taking action. And again, if you could be a little specific about how people could take action.
We offer three things that people can do, that anyone can do, on viraxcomic.net. It also, by the way, is viraxcomic.org and viraxcomic.com. All three of them work. The first thing that you can do, and you can do it right now for yourself, you can encrypt your browser, you can encrypt your phone, you can encrypt your search, and we show you how on the website. So what you can do for yourself, you know, in 10 minutes. The second option that we offer on the website is the NGOs and the media organizations, from CorpWatch to The Intercept to the ACLU, how to get in touch with them. And finally, if you're a whistleblower, ways to leak documents. So most importantly, I think, for people listening to this, what you could do is go out and get a copy of this book and show it to your friends who might be soldiers, who might be Republicans, because this is really a book about soldiers, about brave soldiers and brave government employees who have taken a step forward.
The only thing I would have to add is, under activist groups and media, Project Censored could be in fact listed there. But nevertheless, I have to say the website is wonderful. It's easy to navigate. There's a lot of information there. But the taking action, right, like you said, by protecting your privacy, learning more and spreading information, getting a copy of this book, right? And this is so accessible. I could easily see junior high teachers, high school teachers, as well as community college up to university professors using this in multiple classes, not just literature, but also history, poli-sci, sociology, across the spectrum. And it looks like a very, very important work.
It's a book that was conceived that way. We want to reach out to schools and libraries and spread the information.
Protap Chatterjee, any last words?
Thank you for supporting our work. Thank you to Project Censored. And again, if you get the book also explains how hacking, tracking, and mass surveillance works. So it's kind of a guide to these technologies. So if you weren't sure what was happening and what the government was doing, you can learn it from this book.
Protap Chatterjee, Khalil Bandib, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored Show. Their new book is Varax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. Learn more at varaxcomic.net or .org or .com. VeraxComic.net, .org, .com. I'm Mickey Huff, and this is the Project Censored Show. After this brief musical break, we'll be joined by Professor Julie Fichette. We'll be talking about the hashtag MeToo campaign, sexual harassment, and the media. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about sexual harassment in the media. We'll be talking about the latest hashtag MeToo social media campaigns in response to sexual harassment, sexual assault, that of course not only is happening in celebrity culture, but is ferociously widespread in our culture in the United States. And we are joined by a good friend of Project Censored, co-president of ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education, Julie Frechette. Dr. Julie Frechette is a professor of communication and chair of communication at Worcester State University in Massachusetts. She teaches media studies, critical cultural studies, media education, and gender representations. She has written books, including Developing Media Literacy in Cyberspace, Pedagogy and Critical Learning for the 21st Century Classroom. She also co-authored a book, Media in Society. So, Julie Frechette, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Mickey.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to hear your perspectives and to get your wisdom on media and critical media literacy education, but especially about your areas of expertise on sexism, sexual harassment within media organizations. As you wrote for us regarding Fox News not long ago, earlier this year, you can go to projectcensored.org and read Julie Frechette's article, Sexual Harassment in the Media. But since then, Julie Frechette, things have really kind of exploded with the Harvey Weinstein implications. Could you just jump us in here into this topic and where we are?
It's incredible that in just a few, five or six months since I had actually written that piece, looking at what was happening at Fox News, and it was basically an implosion because of different sexual harassment scandals and the culture of sexual harassment that they promoted at Fox News. Since that time, we've had what I would call a great unraveling of additional cases, and the Harvey Weinstein one is the perfect example, very contemporary, but it's been almost like a domino effect even since that story broke. So, for example, we hear that NPR, National Public Radio, their head of news, has been placed on leave because he had past harassment allegations that surfaced in his tenure at the New York Times and also with one young intern who has since come forth. So that's taking place right now. And we're hearing, of course, other filmmakers, other directors as well being implicated in all of this. So I think what it's telling us is that we're now at a moment historically where there's perhaps a tipping point or a shift in tide where women are feeling collectively that they, as they hear more and more stories of women coming out talking about sexual harassment publicly, whether it's through social media campaigns or through some of the different interviews taking place in Hollywood, I think women are feeling like it's a safer place to come out, to join with one another, and to share their stories. So it seems as if finally some corporate media are willing to talk about this in a way that perhaps for many, many decades it's been ignored. Not to say that it's always covered perfectly, and I wonder how long the momentum will be sustained in terms of talking about how to stop and prevent this from continuing in all sorts of different organizations and workplace settings, but it's a start. It really is a start.
Well, this definitely is a tipping point because we know that these kinds of things go on and have gone on for decades, and the number of people coming out, particularly men, saying, oh, yes, I should have said more, Quentin Tarantino tells us, and you know, and many others. I mean, and they know that these things go on, and yet they did nothing to stop it because they all had kind of skin in the game, no pun intended, but you know what I mean? They all were just kind of looking out for their own interests, and it's almost like just a normalized part of that culture that it's like, well, this is what happens over here, and that's, I mean, again, it's as if the civil rights movement and feminist movements never happened in some of these sectors of society.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, you bring up a really good point, which is that these things get normalized in the culture. And one of the best articles that I read recently was on BuzzFeed, and it was looking at how we had so many producers and directors get away with this for so long. And it's, well, you know, they were called geniuses, or they were called avant-garde, or people that were trying something creative, right? They had a juvenile love for provocation, as a lot of these justifications went on. But when you look more carefully, we have to look at what impact did this kind of brutality or exposing women to this kind of harassment, whether it was behind the screen or sometimes even provoked in terms of on screen, people watched, and it was a culture in Hollywood where you just didn't speak up too loudly because everybody wanted to stay employed.
And big name people, you know, yeah. with Ben Affleck, and I mean people that have their own checkered past.
Good point. There's even a discussion of, there was in this particular article, there was a discussion about Shelley Duvall and her role in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and how, you know, it was a brutal, brutal time for her, because the way that Kubrick wanted her to play that role out, she had to constantly be crying. She had to constantly be shown, you know, in a murderous rage. And that even, you know, Jack Nicholson later says, yeah, you know, when he was asked about it, he corroborated her version of the events, saying, yeah, it wasn't good. You know, she went through way too much. I've never seen anyone go through such unbearable conditions. Well, you know, that might have been fine in, you know, the 1970s, but why is this stuff still going on now today? And I think that's where maybe that turning point is happening, where women are starting to speak up, men are starting to speak up and say, enough is enough. So even in the music industry, I mean, this is not just relegated to Hollywood in terms of movie making, but, you know, you have Bjork just basically accused the director, Lars von Trier, of sexual harassment in the film that she was in, Dancer in the Dark. She didn't name him by name, but that's the only film that this musician has been in. And so, you know, this is starting to get people to look at how the folks who are in the power seat, those who are directing, those who are in charge of the creative production in Hollywood or in the music industry, they're taking advantage of their power, because all this sexual harassment really comes down to who holds the cards, who has the power to exploit someone else. And in these systems, there's a lot of young talent. They want to break through in whatever industry they're trying to get into in the creative arts, but it's not easy, and so there's a pattern there, a systematic pattern of taking advantage of these women in those vulnerable moments. And until you have a lot more female producers and a lot more women who are holding those power positions, it's not going to change until that happens.
Indeed, and I was just thinking when you were talking, I'm blanking on the name of the person. One of the women that experienced this had a piece, a pretty prominent piece, where she was discussing how she, too, had experienced Weinstein and these things, this kind of harassment. But as someone that was a writer and as a creative force, and not just someone that was a young person that was trying to find their way through as an actress in Hollywood, she said that somehow empowered her to get out of the situations that she was in, knowing that it wasn't going to make or break her per se, because she didn't buy into the normalization of it. Like you said, back in the 70s, when you were talking about Nicholson, Jack Nicholson, you said, well, maybe that was okay in the 70s, but not now. But it probably wasn't okay back in the 70s either, or any time. And that's part of that normalization process, right?
That's right.
That women, young women in particular, this invisible kind of pressure and repression to sort of go along, to get along,
right?
And that is such a massive psychological burden, among other things, including economic.
So when I said that may have been seen as permissible in the 70s, I don't mean on behalf of whether this ethically was something that should have happened.
I
mean is, well, I guess it's a great point to bring up, which is that the culture and the media certainly didn't write about it, and if anything, all they did was revere Kubrick and not talk about what Shelley Duvall went through. So at that time period, it seemed like the culture wasn't ready to talk about this or reflect on it, certainly not the media industries themselves. They weren't going to expose what was happening and how problematic this was by looking at the standpoint of the women going through this. But now it seems as if there's finally some discussion. But the piece that you referred to is Britt Marling. She wrote a very, very important piece on the economics of consent. And she said, look, it's not just about just saying no, but even when you have power, like you said, this is someone who was more from the cultural production, telling stories and creating them as well. As a writer, you know, she held more power than other people, but she said even at that, it still wasn't enough, because, you know, you had Weinstein, who had this record, this pattern of trying to get women seduced in his private location. So she writes about how even the woman who then changed the assistant, who changed the meeting time from a lunch meeting to then a dinner meeting in his private location, she figured, well, if I'm being escorted by this assistant, hopefully everything will be fine. And it turned out it wasn't. So a lot of people still turned a blind eye in the industry, and many people are now saying they knew what was going on. But what Marling is saying in this article, which appeared in the Atlantic magazine, it's fantastic, because she says it's gatekeepers that we have to look at, and sort of the power imbalance that comes from the fact that they hold a lot of the power. He could either have made or broken her or other women. So it's a volatile time because these women don't yet have their careers necessarily established. They don't necessarily feel confident on their own at all times. She was able to break away, and many other women and a lot of the celebrities who are now coming forth said, look, I was able to tell a friend or to leave the scene, and it took me a long time to get over this, or it created some friction between me and Weinstein. But at least some of them felt they could get away, but not all of them feel the same way. And so it gets us to looking at class, too, and certainly other markers of difference that keep some women from being able to feel that confidence. So I think when we look at what feminists have talked about in the 80s and the 90s, they came up with standpoint theory to say, well, let's look at how one's standpoint or location, where they come from, their position in society, how does that shape their experience of the world, their self, and, you know, how they encounter different obstacles. And I think what's happening now with these celebrity revelations, it's very easy to target one person. There's a lot of en masse discussion about this. But some of these celebrities, they're proven. They have money now. They have status. And they have a voice. They're afforded a voice at this point in time. But they've had to prove themselves before they could get that kind of courage to speak out. For so many other women, particularly women of color, women who are disenfranchised, it's much harder for them to feel like they're able to participate in this discussion of saying, now let's expose those who have engaged in such wrongdoing and violence against women. It's certainly something to look at. And when you look at Hollywood in particular, you're talking about almost a closed system where the majority of cultural production in corporate media and in Hollywood, those are the folks who are producing and reproducing not just the gatekeeping, who gets to be successful, who gets starred, who doesn't advance or get chosen for a particular film or program, but there's also this double situation, if you will. I don't know how to express, but it's almost like a twofold problem, because then these folks who are the gatekeepers also produce the stories that are told about women. Wait. So many of those stories, what Britt Marling talks about is she says, well, these stories in the first place are very misogynistic, they're sexist, there's harassment shown in the films themselves.
Most of them.
Yeah, and so she says, look, one of the things we might start doing is stop watching those films where women are exploited. You know, we shouldn't be supporting and having cultural acclaim for things where women are shown being sexually abused or harassed or humiliated. We have to look at the power that men have in cultural production as gatekeepers, but also in the types of stories that they tell.
It's the power of the patriarchy, and it goes to the political class.
Yep.
And there's such overlap here in the political culture and what's going on in Hollywood. Like you mentioned, it's not just Hollywood. And thank you, by the way, for the Marling reference in the Atlantic article. That's the one I couldn't remember. I remembered the story, but I had forgotten the source, and thank
sure.
you for bringing that up. We're speaking with Julie Frechette. She is a professor and chair of communication at Worcester State University in Massachusetts. She teaches courses on media studies, critical cultural studies, media education, gender representatives, is author of numerous books on these topics and on media and critical media literacy. Julie Frechette, there were a couple points there that I wanted to kind of spring from.
Wait a second. Before we attack each other and tear ourselves to shreds like a pack of maniacs, let's just open the sack first and see what's actually in it. It might not even be worth the trouble.
What do you think? I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Hi.
A rancid apple core, two worm-eaten banana peels, a moldy rice cake, a dried-up pickle, tin of sardine, bones, a pile of broken eggshells, an old smushed-up rotten gizzard with maggots all over it.
Okay, it's worth it.
That was a scene from the Wes Anderson movie Isle of Dogs, which features animation expertise from our guest today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by a sculptor, a designer, and an animation producer and director. Paul Herod, welcome back to the show.
Hi there, Conj.
It's been a while, but when was the last time you were in the studio with
us? I think that might have been 8 or 9 years ago. It was to talk about the film screenings at Mother's that I host monthly. I think it was back when I was still showing Italian Westerns, so they were spaghetti Western nights.
Anyway, yes, I want to ask you about this animated feature film that's been put together by Wes Anderson, along with a redoubtable team of animators, artists, fabricators, and set builders. But first, let me set the stage, so to speak. It's 2015, and you're at the Burning Man Arts Festival in Nevada. You've left the business world behind. You're roaming the endless playa, blue skies above, and then your cell phone goes off.
Yeah. Normally, when I go to Burning Man, I turn off the phone. It's my timepiece and a camera, but not a communication device. But on this occasion, I was checking the weather, happened to notice that there was an email from somebody who mentioned my friend Nelson Lowry, and I said, well, what's that about? Nelson, as you know...
Well, he's a production designer.
Production designer at Leica.
For Kubo and the Two Strings, yeah?
He was the production designer on Kubo, as well as Paranorman, but prior to that, he'd been production designer on Fantastic Mr. Fox and art director on Corpse Bride. He's a very dear friend of mine, and because he was doing Kubo, he was unavailable to do the production design on Isle of Dogs, but he recommended me. So I look at this email, and with a very spotty cell signal, I'm able to make contact with Jeremy Dawson, the producer, and Jeremy wants to send me a copy of the script and an animatic of about the first 35 minutes of the film. And there's no way I can download or look at any of this stuff while I'm in Black Rock City. So I hitched a ride out in the middle of a dust storm. I had a little sign saying Reno. The very first car that passed me picked me up, which was really nice. Dropped me off at the Reno airport, and I flew back to Portland where I could download the script, and I was just thrilled because I thought the script was just incredible. But I figured they had a lot of other people they were looking at. But yeah, about 3 days later, I'm on the phone with Wes Anderson, and about 4 days after that, I'm on a plane to London. So it was go, go, go. And I certainly didn't have any time to settle any affairs before going, but went straight into it. It was basically at the point when they had moved into Three Mills Studios in East London. So Adam Stockhausen had been working on the film since maybe April or May, but he was moving on to work on Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg's film. So he just did the mind meld with me, and I took it over from that point. And I was there throughout most of the shooting. It continued for about 3-4 months after I left, but all the designs were pretty much nailed at that point.
So like a good animator, you just moved into the style that Adam Stockhausen had established when he was production designer then.
Yeah, Adam and Wes. I mean, if you've seen Wes Anderson's films, you know that there is a style there, a very distinct style, and the way that images are composed, it's something that belongs very much to him. And so he is very, very involved in the whole design approach.
Well, I don't know how hands-on Wes was with Isle of Dogs. There are tales of him Skyping in from France to the set of Fantastic Mr. Fox back in the day. So did the animation team have a lot of leeway?
No, not really. The thing is that Wes wasn't necessarily on set all that much, but he was on the film pretty much 24/7. It was astounding. I mean, I probably shared 15 emails with him a day.
Wow.
So it was almost like a regular conversation. You know, on the occasions when he would come to visit the set, you could tell that he just loved this stuff. And he was almost giddy with delight at everything that he saw. And I think by being in a remote location and just, you know, having stuff sent to him and being able to respond on email actually allowed him to maintain a certain coolness, to not necessarily show the enthusiasm that he was probably feeling. And it was a way of making sure that we gave him precisely what he had in mind, and to not ever say, well, that's really beautiful, let's go with that. It gave him a certain amount of leeway to be less seduced immediately by what we were offering up. It wasn't always easy, and people would wonder why we were doing it this way. And my mantra throughout the whole production was, hey, there's only one person on this project who knows how to make a Wes Anderson film, and you're not it.
Yeah, tell us about the landscape. Simon Weiss, who was the incredible set builder who did the miniatures for the Grand Budapest Hotel, he was there building these epic landscapes. So there were two main landscapes, Megasaki City and Trash Island.
Right. Well, it became quickly apparent that we weren't building sets in the traditional sense. We were building shots. So when you see the film, what you're going to notice is that there are some grand views that we see in a single shot, and we never see that particular view again. But Simon's team built some absolutely amazing stuff, including the establishing shot of Megasaki City that opens the film. That's really quite beautiful. But he also created a lot of our initial establishing shots of Trash Island. And on Trash Island, we travel from zone to zone. It was a very interesting design process because...
Yeah, each zone has its own unique color scheme and arrangement of characters.
Yeah. Well, the initial inspiration for a lot of these, particularly establishing shots and these tableaus, was the ukiyo-e illustrations from 19th century Japan, images by Hokusai and Hiroshige of oftentimes pastoral landscapes, but interesting, you know, sort of epic landscapes as well, land bridges and these images at the edges of an archipelago. And the idea was to take those kinds of compositions, to create something like that, but instead of a pastoral image of nature, they would instead be completely dominated by trash. And then, because a sizable part of the film is essentially a journey from one part of Trash Island to another, we wanted to distinguish these zones. So in the very first scene where our hero pack, the main dog characters, are introduced, the tones are all rust, and it's all just big piles of rusty metal and puddles of copper-colored mud that's sort of moist. And we were drawing a lot from the photography of Edward Bertinsky, who is somebody who has documented these sort of trash and junk landscapes, the sort of crisis that humanity is facing with the disposal of trash. But his photographs have this incredible beauty to them. It was an interesting way of approaching the trash. We wanted each of the images to have this beautiful, hellish landscape. It would look seductive and horrifying at the same time. I was really kind of inspired by some sets in Satyricon.
Fellini's Satyricon, right?
Yeah. I am a huge fan of Danilo Donati, too, one of the great production designers who did Satyricon and Casanova, a lot of Fellini's films.
Now, if you're accosted by a seatmate on an airplane who asks you, what's the job of a production designer, what do you say? What's your pitch?
Well, it can... It can be a range of things. The production designer, strictly speaking, is the person who is driving the look of the film. And in the case of working with Wes Anderson, it is a very tight collaboration with the director to drive that look.
You know, London and Portland share more than just sloppy weather. There's a huge talent base of stop-motion animators, and it's interesting that there are two feature films that are very Japanese-inflected that have come out very close to each other, Kubo and the Two Strings and Isle of Dogs.
Yeah, no, the coincidence wasn't lost on any of us. It was pretty interesting. And the fact that Nelson and I are, you know, good friends, we do a certain amount of comparing of notes. It was pretty interesting that we were both working on these films at the same time. I had a graphics artist, Chinami Narakawa, who I brought over from Japan, too. It was very important on this to have, particularly in the graphics department, to have Japanese people. And Erica Dorn had sort of headed up the graphics department. She grew up in Japan and is Japanese and French. And it was nice to get her perspective on things, because she would not only be able to tell us whether something did or did not jibe in terms of being accurate to Japanese culture, but she also had an understanding of how an outsider would see things, because she's lived in London for 10 years, and so she really was able to see things from both sides.
Well, the history of cultural exchange between Japan and the West goes back centuries. You go back to the 19th century, and there were heavy influences between the Impressionists and the Tokyo School. And in the film world, of course, there's Akira Kurosawa and Jean-Pierre Melville. There's Shohei Imamura and Quentin Tarantino. That said, I do hear from some young artists who are a bit more leery these days. So was there ever a concern while you were building the world of Megasaki City that there might be accusations of cultural appropriation?
Yeah, always. I think that's always sort of something at the back of your mind. And I think our answer to that was to try to honor the history of Japanese art and Japanese cinema as much as we possibly could. Look, I have to say that, you know, particularly with art and film, I think the work of Kurosawa and of Hokusai are gifts to the world. And, you know, I can't speak for those artists, but I have to think that they would feel kind of the same way. And the fact is, cultural appropriation is something that goes back pretty far. And in fact, some of the people who we as filmmakers are accused of appropriating, in fact, appropriated themselves.
Well, I know that you're a fan of Yasuhiro Ozu, the iconic director of Tokyo Story, started out making silent films. Well, he's considered the most Japanese of film directors, but yeah, certainly there are still some Western influences in his early work, especially his comedies.
Yeah, his comedies are, you know, the Ozu's pre-war output feels like an entirely different filmmaker from the post-war output. I think the work that he did post-war really was very much about trying to hold on to Japan, the Japan that he knew, before it disappeared completely. And in fact, I certainly owe a great debt of gratitude to Ozu for creating these domestic scenes and giving us a sense of what the average person's life was like, particularly in the post-war period, because Tokyo Story especially, I think, is such a rich, rich portrait of what life in Japan was like in you know, the 4 or 5 years following the war. And I'd been thinking about it all along. We had a montage of domestic scenes, and I was definitely drawing from mostly Ozu's later color films in putting those together.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser.
And I'm your engineer. Here to remind you that Moving On is coming up shortly. If you tuned in looking for Lori Sonnenfeld, this week's featuring special guest Ryan Harvey. Stay tuned for the rest of this conversation.